The 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 221, AIDS, Culture, and Condemnation, A Father's Response Based on Data Over Tradition, by Dwight E. Cook, and Remembering Brad, by Wayne Scow.
We will hear from Wayne Scow, who is Professor of English and Chair, Department of English and Philosophy, at Idaho State University, where he has been a faculty member since 1967. He received his PhD in comparative literature from the University of Iowa and is co-editor of Peculiar People, Mormons and Same-Sex Orientation, as well as the author of the forthcoming book, Remembering Brad, on the loss of a son to AIDS. Comments on this session will be given by Mark Bigler, who is the Director of Community Education at the Utah AIDS Foundation. He is a licensed clinical social worker and a certified sex therapist. He received his MSW at the University of Utah and his PhD in human sexuality and health education at New York University. We'll turn the time over to Dwight Cook. Thanks, Boyd. As an engineer, I've grown to love data. And so the original reviewers of this paper, as I handed it to them, they had one comment, and that was too much data. So every reiteration or every version had a little less, and I finally could not bring myself to totally throw out some of the data, so I have a handout up here that's my compromise to myself. It's a peace offering to myself, and so some of my sacred data is in the handout for people who want to look at it afterwards. And I also have a few copies of this paper available for anyone who would like it. Over 2 years ago, I was talking with a friend of mine, a close friend of mine, on the phone, and I'll call him Mike. In his mid-30s, Mike grew up in an active LDS family, much like my own. Like me, he served a mission and had two children. But unlike me, he was in the last stages of HIV disease, which we more commonly call AIDS. As it has done to so many, HIV disease slowly had taken Mike from middle class to poverty. Each day was a struggle financially, medically, spiritually, and emotionally. And this particular evening, he sounded unusually tired. "I tried to call you last night. Did you have a support group meeting?" I asked. "No," he replied. "I went to the doctor yesterday, and well, I just came home and bawled. I didn't feel up to answering the phone." "What, is your T-cell count down?" I asked. "No," he continued as his voice began to waver. "It's low like it has been for a long time. It's just that there's nothing I can do to stop the headaches. There's nothing I can do to stop the diarrhea." He paused. "There just isn't anything that I can do." Mike's family laid him to rest this spring. In this paper, I examine the role of our LDS tradition in promoting HIV disease. As beneficial as our tradition can be, it appears to harm a significant number of people. I look at how we as LDS parents and leaders have avoided dealing with this group of people and hence promoted HIV disease by denying our own risk and by blaming others. I conclude that there are better ways. We need to improve our traditional approach to sexuality in at least three interrelated ways. We must talk about sex in a relaxed and open way. We must give complete information, and we must stop condemning and stigmatizing. As I present this paper not as a professional, but as a parent, through my volunteer work with Arizona AIDS Project and the National Council on HIV Disease, I have come to know many people who are infected with HIV or affected by someone else who is. Mike is only one of the surprisingly large number of these people who are LDS. The experience of knowing these people has significantly changed how I look at sexual morality, how I look at the LDS tradition, and most importantly, how I look at my children. My daughters mean everything to me. I live for their laughs, and I melt at their smiles. I do not want my children to die of HIV disease. The LDS tradition seems to help substantial numbers of LDS youth remain free of HIV disease, probably more so than the national averages. But our tradition probably hurt Mike. It is no person's fault, and I do not wish to place blame, but our tradition is part of a broader historical politicization of sexuality unique to America. This politicization has led to polarized public discussion of sex consisting of emotional rhetoric from all sides. It has more to do with commercial and political power than it does with health or happiness. We as parents have inherited this polarized discussion with its emotional baggage, as did our parents. An important part of the motivation of changing our approach to sexuality is to understand that LDS people are at risk. I have included references of studies relevant to the level of LDS sexual activity outside of marriage in the handout, because many people in this audience are possibly under the perception that LDS people are much less sexually active outside of marriage than others. I will highlight one well-done study that says we may be more active in some ways. Samuel and Cynthia Janis authored a recent and extensive survey of American sexual behaviors that examines religion in general. They conclude that the non-religious are the most likely to have extramarital sex at least once, but the most actively religious are the most likely to have often and ongoing adultery. In addition, they state even with its Bible Belt character, the southern region of the United States has the youngest average age of sexual initiation. With regard to religion in general, they conclude, sociologists have long reported the discrepancy between preachment and practice in American family life, particularly regarding sex practices. As virtually all researchers of mate swapping and group sex have reported, most participants are religiously conservative and active churchgoers. As an aside, I'll comment that I showed that data to a friend of mine, and he immediately commented that he was going to start attending church again. As I've included in the handout, there is data saying that LDS people are as sexually active as national averages, and there are other data saying that they are not. One possible conclusion is that there are fewer LDS people having sex outside of marriage, but those that do may be participating in more frequent, risky behaviors. Whatever the actual levels of sexual behaviors are, significant numbers of LDS people are at risk. Christ is quoted as saying, "What man of you, having 100 sheep, is if he lose one of them, doth not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after that which is lost until he find it?" Christ referred to 1%. Surely we should address the needs of 20, 30, or perhaps 50%. LDS people traditionally avoid addressing our sexually active brothers, sisters, and children by placing blame. In statistics that compare LDS populations to other populations, we often boil the question down to who one labels LDS. Is it a person who is married in the temple, who is baptized? Baptism signals the individual's responsibility for her or his commitment to the church, but when does the church organizationally and culturally commit to the individual? Our traditional pattern is to cite church responsibility if the statistic looks good and favorable, and personal choice if the statistic does not. If people get married, appear happy, and live monogamously, then it is because of gospel teachings, and if they don't, it is their own fault. I argue that we as LDS people, and especially as parents, have the responsibility to examine how our teachings affect all people, regardless of their position in the church. At the core of this issue is our use of the doctrine of free agency, particularly concerning sexuality. Science is just beginning to study sexuality, and growing data suggests strong influences from the age of puberty, culture, hormone levels, and other biological factors. These are all factors which are not under personal control. Complete understanding of the influences in sexual behavior is beyond science at this time, and there is much more involved than agency and choice. Recognizing this complexity in sexuality and many other behaviors could be what the Lord meant when he said, "Judge not, that ye be not judged." Some of the historical parallels that show how self-defeating blaming can be include the bubonic plague and cholera. Both diseases infected marginalized subcultures in their inception. Doctors, as well as civic leaders alike, blamed the disease on lack of a Christian lifestyle and taught that they were punishments from God. These social calamities eventually affected all parts of society in significant and tragic ways. Blaming delayed dealing with the issue and caused many more people to die. LDS people are historically in tune with being a marginalized subculture. Much of the persecution of the church in the 1880s was justified by the popular hatred of polygamy, viewed as many as a grievous sexual immorality. What if a plague had begun in Utah in the 1960s? Would the government have ignored it, thinking it was God's punishment on the Mormons for their immoral behavior? Furthermore, what if Legionnaire's disease first started in a Mormon temple? With the generalized stigma of LDS temple ceremonies by the majority of Americans today, would the government respond as quickly as it did for a group of businessmen? Would so-called family values groups lobby for research funding? Today, we use the same inflammatory verbiage to condemn modern-day disliked minorities as was used against us. It is time that we treat other people with the same open-mindedness and tolerance that we want others to have with us. Blaming accomplishes two things. It gives us the illusion that we have no responsibility, and it gives us the illusion of immunity by letting us view ourselves as morally superior. However, we do have responsibility, and we are not immune. Furthermore, we have great ability and power to act. Research has shown that there is no better role for teaching children than that of parents. Yet research has also shown that few parents are effectively addressing the issue. LDS parents have inherited a potentially destructive tradition, and we have the power to change it. In the face of HIV, we cannot afford to hide behind blame. There are three major aspects of the traditional LDS approach to sexuality that I will examine today. The first one, aspect one, Americans in general have traditionally avoided discussions about sexuality. It is a widespread perception of professionals who deal with LDS populations that this avoidance is echoed in LDS families, if not amplified. Silence, to some degree, is still encouraged in some of the published literature. Silence is in direct opposition to volumes of published research concerning sexuality. It is in direct conflict with how we confront other issues and how we build trust. I find no data indicating that sheltering our children helps or is even possible. There is significant research that shows to wait until a child is older to discuss sex is much riskier than talking to a child when he is young. Talking is essentially essential to learning. To confront HIV, we must discuss sex. Aspect 2, teaching only abstinence until marriage pervades LDS culture and policy. It is based on an underlying fear that if you teach the use of condoms or other safer sex practices, you may influence people to participate in those behaviors who otherwise would have remained abstinent. This fear is not supported by the research. I quote two prominent researchers with Population International. Contrary to popular opinion, sexuality education does not appear to encourage earlier sexual activity. Rather, it teaches young people the skills they need to practice safe and responsible sexual behavior and may encourage young teenagers to delay first intercourse until they are older and more mature. After reviewing 35 studies of sex education programs in several countries, the World Health Organization agreed. C. Everett Koop, M.D., former Surgeon General and conservative evangelical Christian, publicly advocated complete sexual education despite tremendous political and personal repercussions. The Centers for Disease Control recently commissioned a review of U.S.-based school-based sex education programs. 9 leading researchers in the field of adolescent sexual behavior, including one highly respected Mormon, Brent Miller, Ph.D. from Utah State University, arrived at the same conclusion. In general, the most effective sex education programs include postponing sex until marriage as the lowest risk option, using condoms if sex is chosen, developing resistance skills, involving parents, building self-esteem, and increasing extracurricular activities. They avoid issues such as proper gender roles and are not overly detailed. In my opinion, parents will find these elements work very well for their home-based programs. Finally, over-moralization leads to the extreme stigmatization and condemnation of those who participate in sex outside of marriage. This stigmatization is clear in LDS literature. It is also a major contributor to sexual addiction. There has been a long-standing perception among professionals working with alcoholic addiction that LDS people who begin drinking become addicted at a higher rate than the national population of drinkers. I believe that model holds true with sexual addiction as well. Mike, who I discussed earlier, viewed himself as a sexual addict. I see a consistently higher tendency among sexual addiction among LDS people who experience sex outside of marriage than in the general population experiencing sex outside of marriage. When we stigmatize those who participate in sexual behaviors outside marriage, we could be stigmatizing our own children. Even if our child has not participated in sexual behaviors, he or she may accept those labels based on feelings alone. This destruction of self-esteem is a jump start into sexual addiction. Sexual discussions that are limited only to the sacredness of sex within marriage can make sex impersonal and distant. Discussion of the practical day-to-day advantages of sex within marriage can make the benefits tangible, visible, and realistic. Over-moralization also paints a perception of extremes. One is either very virtuous or very carnal. Limited to this perception, a child who masturbates could view himself as condemned as the adulterer and conclude that there is little reason not to participate in more HIV risky behaviors. Our discussion of sex with our children should focus on simple facts with tangible benefits and consequences, not on the stigmatization and condemnation of others. Some of the greatest evidence for long-term benefits of a modified approach to sex is found in other cultures. one of the most respected research groups in the area of teenage sexuality, the Alan Guttmacher Institute, conducted a study of six Western countries and concluded. In the United States, sex tends to be treated as a specific topic set apart from normal life. At the same time, there is much ambivalence. Sex is romantic, but also sinful and dirty. It is flaunted, but something to be hidden. This ambivalence is less apparent in the European countries, where matter-of-fact attitudes seem to be more prevalent. It stands to reason that where sexuality as a whole carries less emotional baggage, sex among teenagers is likely to be dealt with more realistically. Society's openness about sex may be an especially important factor influencing adolescence, fertility, and pregnancy. Michael Wolff authored a compilation of worldwide statistics on various topics, including sexual behaviors. Of the countries Wolff cited, the United States has the youngest average age of first sexual intercourse for both men and women. He shows the United States with the highest rate of teen pregnancy and teen abortions of any modern industrialized country, while the Netherlands has the lowest. It is particularly interesting to contrast the United States directly with the Netherlands because the Netherlands is noted for its open sexual attitudes. It is one of the growing number of countries to legalize same-sex marriages and has some of the most liberal divorce and abortion laws. It is also noted for being relatively non-religious. Wolff's comparison of the United States and the Netherlands follows. Notice that for teen pregnancies per 1,000 teens, the number is 8.1 times greater in the United States. And I put in bold here what is the available Utah data. For teen abortions, the United States has 48 per 1,000 annually, with 5.5 in the Netherlands and 15 in Utah. The average age of first intercourse for boys is 1.8 years younger in the U.S. The average age of first intercourse for girls, 1.5 years younger in the U.S. For extramarital affairs, 7.3 times greater in the United States. Now, the divorce rate is 2.4 times greater in the United States. And interestingly enough, the last statistic is that over the lifetime, the average person will have 2.1 times fewer events of sexual intercourse in the United States than they will in the Netherlands. Okay, what that means is that over the long term, Wolff concludes, I think he sums it up here well. The Dutch have the most sex with the least amount of negative repercussions. The Netherlands has pioneered an open and safe society. It is also noteworthy that while the U.S. has the highest divorce rate in the world, it also has the most people who disapprove of divorce. Likewise, of the countries cited, the United States has the highest number of people condemning homosexuality, and yet has the highest level of women and second highest level of men who say they have had a homosexual experience. In summary, the research indicates that while the LDS tradition of dealing with sexuality is probably better than the prevailing national tradition at reducing the number of people who have sex outside of marriage, it could encourage those who do to participate in sex outside of marriage to participate in more high-risk activities. Most importantly, other traditions exist that help a much larger number of people. Blaming and denial allow us to avoid facing HIV disease, but gain us nothing. We, as parents, have the power to change our tradition. The best tradition is to make sex a frequent and matter-of-fact topic with complete information given without condemning or stigmatizing others. Discussions need not be graphic or sensational. Relaxed discussions of sex in a family can greatly benefit all members. We may not be able to get our children to totally embrace all our ideals, but we may, by changing our tradition, significantly increase the chances that more of them will take a relatively low-risk approach to sex and remain HIV-free. My daughters, who are 9 and 12, have experienced this approach. They have watched me give lectures on HIV disease and have seen me demonstrate the use of condoms on my fingers. It has gotten to the point where if I invite them to go along with me, my youngest says, "Oh, Dad, not another discussion about sex." I do not pretend to know how to be a perfect parent, but when I look them in the eyes and let go of their hands so that they can run off to play outside of my control, I know that I have done my best to give them the tools they need to make responsible decisions themselves and avoid giving them the emotional baggage they do not need. They have the facts and skills regardless of the values they embrace. I began with the story of Mike. I'd like to conclude with the story of Susan. She's an upper middle class mother. She was an upper middle class mother with a perfect life. Although she and her husband were practicing Catholics, they lived in East Mesa, Arizona, which has a high LDS population and influence. In 1988, her oldest son, Steve, then 26, was in the last year of architecture college. He had a well-paying job with a bright future. In December of that year, he came home, sat his parents down, and said, "I have AIDS." After Steve showered and went to bed, Susan spent hours scrubbing and disinfecting every inch of the bathroom. Somehow it seemed that if she scrubbed hard enough, Clorox would make everything all right again. As Susan's friends in East Mesa found out about her son's illness, contact stopped without explanation. Eventually, her husband's boss found out about Steve's illness, and 2 weeks after that, there was a reorganization at the firm. Susan's husband lost his job. Faced with the loss of income and impending medical costs once Steve's insurance ran out, Susan and her husband decided to sell their home in East Mesa and move to a smaller townhouse in Phoenix, where they would be financially better off, closer to Steve, and away from the difficult memories in East Mesa. A few months later, under the pressures of losing a job, selling a house, and having a son with AIDS, Susan's husband died of a heart attack. At her husband's funeral, the people who contracted to buy the house found out that Steve, her son, had AIDS, and even though he was not living in the house they were to buy, they refused to close. Months later, Susan was able to sell her house at a loss. Some weeks later, Steve died in Susan's arms. His 98-pound gaunt and frail body was all that was left. HIV and its stigma had robbed her of her friends, finances, and husband. Finally, it had taken her son. Last Halloween, Susan and one of her friends, another mother who has lost a child to HIV, dressed as fairy godmothers. They went from bar to bar in the Phoenix area, handing out condoms. Since that night, they have become affectionately known as the Condom Queens. HIV cost Susan everything. It cost LDS parents more each day. It cost Mike his life. There are no words to describe the feelings as parents watch HIV slowly rob their children of life. HIV disease, it's ugly in disfigurement and pain, but perhaps more so in stigma. Repentance will not take it away, and HIV does not forgive. No savings account will bring back a loved one. None of the parents who have lost a child to HIV would hesitate for 1 minute to buy 1,000 condoms if it would bring back their child. Information, openness, and communication cost only courage. May we, as LDS parents, find that courage.
morning. I'm happy to be here to share the time with Dwight and Mark, and I appreciate that you've come to be here with us. I appreciate having been invited to come and read a few excerpts from a book that is forthcoming from Signature Press early next year. It is a book called Remembering Brad, and the title really has a double thrust to it. My son Brad is the person who is principally remembered, but I am the one who is doing the remembering, and thus, unavoidably, the book is about me as well as it is about Brad. I've worried a good deal about whether it is seemly, in fact, to display myself as much as is involved in the process of making this book. You know, there are those people who appear on the daytime television interview shows who have had troubles and heavy water to pass through, and they seem to feel that the whole world wants to know about their trouble, and moreover, the whole world ought to know and care about it. And I don't always feel comfortable in watching such people, and am somewhat loath to appear as one of them. I very much hope that after I'm through today, you will not feel embarrassed for me and uncomfortable in that way. And I ask your indulgence if this seems too personal. The book does have an implicit narrative arrangement to it. There is a story there. But I'm afraid I haven't told it as a story from beginning to end. In fact, I did not set out to write a book. I simply started after Brad's death to write about various facets of my experience and his as a way of trying to clarify them, trying to come to terms with them. And my perspective changed as I went along. I wrote one thing, and then a little later another thing, and they did not even agree with each other necessarily. But I eventually concluded that perhaps that process of sorting things out was in itself a kind of interesting process to observe, and so I decided that maybe the book didn't have to have a strict narrative chronological sequence. I have in mind reading today three excerpts from Remembering Brad. The one, quite briefly, is from the prologue, simply to set the scene. Then the second excerpt is actually written by Brad himself. One of the parts of the book that I like very best of all is Brad's contribution to it, because he kept a series of journals over a period of about 10 years, and I thought that though I can't read enough here to give you a sense of his development in coming to terms with his homosexuality, he did address that increasingly in the journals as he got older. And so I want to read just two excerpts from the journal to give you a sense of that. And finally, one of the chapters in the book is called Grieving. And I talk unabashedly, I'm afraid, about my own process of grieving after his death, but of grieving before his death, not only with respect to his impending death from AIDS, but the earlier process of grieving about his homosexuality, which I had been ill-prepared to accept in the beginning. Lifting these things out of their context will make your experience today a little disjointed, I fear, but I hope you will be tolerant of the fact that you're just getting bits and pieces here. Prologue. From New York or Los Angeles to Pocatello is a long way. The distance is not measured simply in miles. Here in this provincial place, in the mountains on the edge of the Snake River Plain, life seems less pressured, less complicated. The distance and difference is partly a matter of pace. We don't really have a fast lane in Pocatello. What doesn't happen today can wait for tomorrow. And the distance is partly a matter of elbow room. There aren't so many of us compressed together here. Perhaps for that reason our crime rates are low, racial tensions are barely discernible, and you can walk the clean streets in any part of town safely, day or night. When you do feel the urge to get out of town, scenic Idaho is immediately all around you, open and accessible. The sun shines brightly, the air is clear, and you can see the Lost River Range rising above the desert 70 miles away. Our distance from the cosmopolitan places is partly, too, a matter of style. We don't set trends here. We don't dictate fashion. You don't see evidence of great wealth. We're probably not on the cutting edge of anything. Our style and our values are more those of Middle America. Most of us know and like our neighbors. Most of us live conventionally, predictably. Most of us avoid tension-producing extremes. For these reasons, Pocatello is a comfortable place where things seem under control. Here you feel largely sheltered from the ills that beset contemporary urban life. Here you generally expect life to be kind. In this sunny environment where he had grown to manhood, my eldest son Brad died of AIDS. That was not kind. Somehow, it still seems to me, 6 years later, and incidentally, let me say that the year count in here gets a little bit more out of date with each year. So Brad died 7.5 years ago. Still seems to me 6.5 years later not the sort of thing that should happen in southern Idaho. The cultural geography is just altogether wrong. That sounds terribly naive, I know. For, of course, taboo sexual orientation and taboo illness and untimely death occur everywhere, including even sheltered, uncosmopolitan places. But they aren't always acknowledged. Somehow we pretend they aren't there. So my story of the brief life of a gay son and the response of his Pocatello family is different in some respects from what it would have been had it occurred in New York or San Francisco, for it takes place in a conservatively backlit context of denial. And that is precisely why I think this story should be told. Though it seems anomalous, the wrong events in the wrong place, I know now what I did not know 6 years ago, that this in outline is a very common story lived by many homosexual persons and their families in Middle American places like Pocatello, a story unfortunately suppressed because of culturally induced shame and fear. As a result, those who dare not express their pain in the face of society's intolerance suffer in closeted silence, and the world goes on thinking that such things occur only in the far-out environments of New York and San Francisco. This book is about Brad, whose temperamental complexity stretched the scenarios normally planned for young Mormons. In writing about him, and by that means attempting to understand his complexity, I have come to realize that this book is also about me and about that process of sorting things out. The years continue to pass, yet I cannot be done with thinking of him and the impact of his life on mine. In a manner I would never have predicted, he became and continues to be my teacher. That is a paradox worth exploring. From Brad's journal, after he had lived in Los Angeles for nearly 4 years and was just returning to Idaho, sort of to pick up the pieces of things that had been happening to him there and to embark on a program of study at Utah State University in landscape architecture. May 3rd, 1983. I've almost finished the second month of my Babylonian captivity. In other words, I'm still in Idaho. Being here dredges up all sorts of memories, many of them unpleasant. Old feelings of guilt, that prison without walls, adolescent emotions from high school, which amaze me in that they can still twist me around the same as before. Emotions of inadequacy, lack of confidence, the need to measure up to the old macho creed. Just walking around these streets brings the boogies back. And then there's the inescapable dark hand of the church. This, too, surprises me, for I had forgotten how much suppressed anger, frustration, and hatred can accompany one who dares to be independent. Living at home is both a cradle and a curse. On the one hand, it's nice to be among these people with whom I grew up and have shared so much, to feel part of a unit, to be needed by my family, to draw some strength from them. And yet I find myself retreating back into some of my old adolescent patterns of suppressed anger and frustration in my relationship with my parents, as I am again temporarily dependent on them. They have given me great leeway to do as I want, and yet I still, perhaps only in my mind, feel the subtle pressures and my own anxiety over our differences and the need to prove myself in their eyes. In ways, I almost feel like an anthropologist on a mission to study the nuclear family from within. I feel both attached and curiously removed from them, as though I had never seen them before. In some ways, I really hadn't. It's difficult to be objective about something you've not broken with yet, as a child, not having any basis for comparison. The question is, do I really like these people? A question I wouldn't have dreamed of asking at one time. The answer, by the way, is yes. Blood is thicker than water. Still, I feel, perhaps because of my age or perhaps because of my sexual orientation, the urge to go far away from them. I feel that somehow I don't quite fit, a square peg in the proverbial round hole. And also I feel sad about my inability to communicate or their inability to understand what it really means to be gay, that flame that burns in my soul. I am beginning to despair that they will ever understand. Accept, yes. Understand, no. A source of great hurt for me. By not understanding, they, who could be my most delightful and satisfying companions, are separated in spirit from me. Without meaning to be tragic, I think I have no choice but to go away, to seal off the hurt with distance and occasional phone calls. Perhaps this will change with time. July 13th, 1983. I realize intuitively and at times through conscious deliberation that happiness, long-term happiness, is not to be gained by life in the fast lane, by a constant pursuit of transient pleasure, which is what my few years in Los Angeles so largely consisted of. Anything else seemed to be a bother, to be standing in the way of the earnest and real. Thus I spent a lot of time, and still do, feeling dissatisfied because life gets in the way. That is, I don't have enough money. I have to work for a living. I can't be two places at once. I have to go back to school, etc. I could make a long list. The vision of life I was shown in L.A., or perhaps the vision I saw because of my own predilections and fantasies, was one of endless creation, a kind of movie world, a fantastic realm where things are always too cool. Such a world, however, always seemed to be constantly evasive, just beyond my fingertips. This was much the case for most of my L.A. friends also, none of us having been born with a silver spoon in our mouth. Yet we ached for, and yes, at times we felt we had attained that idyllic moment. But it always seemed to finish too quickly. What a crash. What a disappointment. You mean I'm not one of the beautiful people? Cinderella, at 12 o'clock midnight. Back to the ash pit. Back to the struggle. The endless, frustrating pursuit. Somehow I want to reconnect with the real world. Life isn't the fantasy I wanted it to be. And looking back, already I'm beginning to see how young I was. To go through all that would be hard on anybody. I have a few battle scars to show for it. And then he has a quotation from Brideshead Revisited. But I was in search of love in those days, and I went full of curiosity and the faint, unrecognized apprehension that here, at last, I should find that low door in the wall which others I knew had found before me, which opened on an enclosed and enchanted garden, which was somewhere not overlooked by any window in the heart of that gray city. Well, I think that maybe gives you a sense that Brad was complex and he did not see things in black and white, and he certainly acknowledged that his course in life was one that he bore responsibility for, and he did not avoid that responsibility. From the chapter on grieving. We tell ourselves stories in order to live, writes Joan Didion at the outset of her book, The White Album. She is referring to a time when the culture in which she lived and the events of her life seemed particularly devoid of coherence. Quote, we live in the suicide for the social or moral lesson in the murder of five. We interpret what we see, select the most workable of the multiple choices. We live entirely by the imposition of a narrative line upon disparate images, by the ideas with which we have learned to freeze the shifting phantasmagoria which is our actual experience. Unquote. We are thus driven, Didion implies, because the human psyche characteristically does not like to confront ontological chaos or ethical nihilism. Existence must be purposeful, its elements connected. And when we are confronted with the possibility of absurdity, our minds go quickly to work imposing patterns of meaning that have their real origins in ourselves. It is defensive action. Ingeniously, perhaps desperately, we devise strategies rooted in myth, superstition, or other specious correspondences to make existence bearable. Francis Bacon, that severe empiricist, would accuse us of worshiping idols of the tribe, the cave, the theater. We tell ourselves stories in order to live. With more than a little conviction that Didion and Bacon are right, I nevertheless have seen in myself during the past 3 years this tendency. These were the 3 years immediately following Brad's death. This necessity to find purposeful coherence in the absurd fabric of my recent experience. Contemplating Brad's death before and after, my mind has pursued many an avenue, many a what if, that might hold the unthinkable at bay. I am not referring to large order theological solutions, not, for example, the view that God willed that Brad should die, called him home, has another purpose for him just now. That premise contains several problems for me. Rather, I refer to much more modest evidence of coherence, small connections that might be a sign, however indefinite, of hope. Let me cite an example. We had a ficus fig tree in our living room that we were fond of. In our previous dwelling, it had flourished for several years. But ficus figs are delicate. The conditions of their well-being are easily unbalanced. When we moved to 20th Street in May of 1986, 6 months before Brad's death, and he was living with us, the degree of light or the humidity to which the plant was exposed must have been subtly altered, or it may have acquired a disease. The tree began to lose its leaves in June, which was worrisome. But no matter, before long it put on new light green ones. They grew to a little more than an inch in length, then they too fell. Before long, new leaves appeared, only to abort after several weeks. The plant settled into a cycling, a cycle, a series of leafings and unleafings, attempting gamely to rejuvenate itself. Sandra, who has a green thumb, ministered devotedly to the ficus, and I thought she might save it. Somehow that fig tree's struggle for life became a line for me with Brad's simultaneous struggle. I watched them both day by day, looking for any little indications of improvement, any signs of hope. If it could pull off a miracle and survive, so could he. It was not superstition exactly. I knew full well that there was no material connection between the two. Yet I can understand, as a result of my preoccupation with this little tree, how a troubled mind searches for correspondences, how it wants to invest the symbol with power. You focus your mental energy, your faith, on the object of your grave concern, and when that effort seems not enough to affect your desire, you cast about you to find some external help. Oh, how I watched that tree, how I wanted it to recover. With each renewed effort it made to put forth leaves, I thought, surely the tide has turned. Surely this is the beginning of its return to health. Sandra tried this, she tried that. More light, less light, varied the watering, fertilized the soil, treated for insects. Gradually, with each new cycle, there were fewer new leaves and fewer remaining old ones. I refused to acknowledge the decline. Several weeks before Brad died, it was clear that the ficus was finished. Another example. It was in late September, and I was feeling particularly burdened with grief. We had come to the point of planning for the end. On a Saturday afternoon, I went out alone to hike on Haystack Mountain just to get away for a few hours, just to get to where I could see the big views. While I was up there on the mountainside, a thought came to me powerfully. I would tell Brad that after he died and passed over, he should find Paul, my youngest brother. Paul had been just 8 when Brad was born. The young uncle and his nephew, the first grandchild, had had a special fondness for each other. Paul had been dead for 20 years. He had been over there. He would know his way around. He could be a guide. For Brad to find him would be to find an immediate friend, a familiar haven. This ordinary thought, so predictable in a way, came to me with the force of an epiphany. It brought incredible comfort to me as I descended the mountain. I must say that the afterlife for which I hope is not something which normally I feel comfortable or confident imagining in particular detail. Agnosticism accompanies my existential faith. Knowing that Brad's view was somewhat like my own, I should have been prepared, I suppose, for his response to the comforting advice I offered him on my return. He disparaged it. He entertained it seemingly for all of 3 seconds. And dismissed it. One greatly appealing little reconciling story out the window. Yet another modest example. The following summer, after Brad's death, once again I was on Haystack Mountain alone. Descending from the summit, I rested for a short while in an aspen grove on the steep, shady north side of the ridge. Out in the azure, only a little above my eye level, 2 large hawks were riding the thermal updrafts, endlessly, effortlessly circling, gliding, rising. It was lovely to watch. They stayed on and on. It came to me that somehow I was watching Brad. At the time of his death, Sandra had said of his features, sharpened by emaciation, "He looks like an eagle, and now he is soaring beautifully." I remembered that image because I liked its connotations of the raptor's virility and freedom, which seemed so appropriate to Brad's temperament. Wasn't it right that Brad would return to this mountain environment he loved? Wasn't it good to see him up there riding gracefully, so obviously at peace, in harmony with his elements? Wasn't it nice that he had found a companion with whom to share this hour? And hadn't he chosen this form and this time and this place to communicate to me from beyond death that he yet lives and thinks of us in the Idaho landscape where his mortal sensibilities were formed? I know this little experience was nothing more than poetic indulgence, an expression of my own deep longing, a little story I told myself in order to live through that particular period. And yet it was comforting to me. Dreams also must surely be included among the stories we tell ourselves, although their genesis in the unconscious may sometimes make their intent less obvious. I am not a great dreamer, but I have dreamed of Brad several times since his death with an immediacy and vividness that were more overpoweringly real than waking life. In one of those dreams, he returned to us like Lazarus from the dead. To me, in the dream, this was wholly unexpected. It was amazing. He was pale and thin, not merely from his mortal illness, but because death itself had been an ordeal. Yet he was smiling gently, and his countenance was radiant. Clearly, he was alive and mending, and in the way of becoming transcendent. I believe the reunion was as sweet to him as it was to me. I put my arms around him, and I knew it was he. I knew it was he, intact, tangible. At this point in the short dream, I felt a beatitude of such depth and joyousness as I think I have never felt in life. I awoke shortly, but the afterglow lingered through the morning. What is one to make of such a dream? I dare not conclude that it was an objective vision. It is too easily explained as subjective wish fulfillment, the subconsciously created form in which my love and longing found expression. But who can say for certain where fantasy ends and reality begins? I do know that the feelings evoked by the experience were sublime. It was as if I, on honeydew, had fed and drunk the milk of paradise. I'm struck by the similarities between the psychological stages in the dying process as described by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, denial, anger, bargaining, despair, acceptance, and the progress of grieving that others experience. That the stages so nearly correspond for the two groups is not surprising at all when one recognizes that the dying person is, after all, so obviously a griever. I want to comment here on the effects of anger as a part of that process. One of the ways the mind attempts to cope with inscrutable deprivation is to find someone or something to blame. That at least diminishes to a degree the absurdity by providing a cause and effect explanation, and it provides an outlet for frustration. As I observed the extended suffering of my homosexual son, whom did I blame? Not Brad. Having already concluded that he was not responsible for his homosexual orientation, I considered him in his total experience more sinned against than sinning. He made mistakes, but he learned from them. How could I be angry at his mother? Could I be angry at his mother and me? Ultimately not. Setting aside my earlier homophobia, we had tried hard to understand and assist him. We too had changed. Did I blame God? No. God's purposes are ultimately beyond my ken. And while I assume that they are benign, it would be foolish for me to presume to judge the infinite. But did I blame our society for its closed-mindedness and intolerance? Yes, I did. For those cultural attitudes were finite, very close to home, and there seemed to me little excuse for such callous indifference on the part of a self-declared religious nation toward the plight of persons like Brad. And did I feel anger towards some of those institutional pillars of Christianity which ought to have been in the forefront promoting tolerance, understanding, and a climate fostering individual self-realization? Yes, I did. For those institutions were immediately, conveniently at hand, and I thought their failures were stunning. Our relationship with our own church was inescapably affected. We felt how ironic it was that the presumed haven of spiritual comfort for those distressed was to us, during our long period of perplexity, remote from what was going on in our lives. In the greatest extremity that any of us in the family had faced, the church simply was not there for us. How was this possible? It was not just that the Latter-day Saint doctrinal position on homosexuality is condemnatory. This was only symptomatic of a larger problem concerning the Church's epistemological view of how spiritual truth becomes known. As the Mormons see it, prophets and others in the hierarchy are the conduits through whom God speaks. That means that on sensitive issues, real dialogue is pointedly discouraged. That means that in Latter-day Saint congregations, there is no openness to discuss a matter such as homosexuality, except to dismiss it a priori. Officially, the Church shows little interest in examining or crediting experiential truth when it lies outside orthodoxy. Therefore, since our experience over the preceding 7 years had led us to a contrary view of the causes and existential realities of homosexuality, an unspoken barrier had been raised between us and our friends, whose highest loyalty is to the authority of the Church. Under these circumstances, how could we approach our brothers and sisters to share with them the incongruous division between doctrine and the actual experience with which we were struggling? We remained silent. Let me say parenthetically that in the years immediately following Brad's death, the Episcopalians, the Unitarians, the Presbyterians, the Lutherans, the Methodists, all invited us on various occasions, Sandra and I, to come and share our experience with them. They were interested to know what our spiritual path had been like through that ordeal. It's very sad to me that no one connected with the Latter-day Saints ever was interested in that group way in hearing what we had to say. There were, to be sure, several of our Latter-day Saint friends who became aware toward the end of Brad's life of what was happening in our family. These included at least two of our ecclesiastical leaders in whom we confided. On a personal level, these men responded with deep and sincere humanity, but they had no doctrinal comfort for us, nor could they speak out, then or now, to encourage through dialogue in their congregations a clearer, more tolerant understanding of homosexuality and its burdens. For us, the implications of this situation extended beyond the issues relating to homosexuality. The experience simply added dramatic weight to our perception that organized religion is often most concerned with conformity and preservation of the collective status quo. There would have been, I think, no lack of goodwill and support on the part of many of our Latter-day Saint acquaintances if there had been a framework to encourage it. But the rigidity of the institutional Church disarmed both their ability to respond to us helpfully and, not less important, our ability, even our willingness to allow them to do so. I remember two separate well-intentioned members of our ward who said to Sandra and me following Brad's death, "We want you to know that we do not think any the less of you because of what your son became." None of us felt, on those occasions, sufficiently comfortable to pursue the ambiguity of those statements. If I grieved during this period, some part of it was sadness that our spiritual community had been weighed and found wanting. In spite of my increasing unorthodoxy, the Church had always been important to my identity. Now, with some regret, I saw it diminished, fading as a vital force in my life. I see that I'm out of time. If I could read one more page and a half, I'd be grateful. December 5th, 1989, the third anniversary of Brad's death, a day fraught with melancholy. I am remembering that we did not spend his last mortal day entirely at his side. He had been hospitalized for 6 days. Sandra was with him during the morning. About noon, Brad told her he wanted to be quite alone. We understood. After all, we had been hovering about continuously. After work, I stopped in to see how he was, sleeping quietly. I sat there in his room for half an hour, then went home. About 9:30, I said, "Let's go to the hospital." When we got there, we were startled to find him in extremis, struggling to breathe, sweating in his agony. Why had the nurses not called us? We had needed to be there, if not for his sake, at least for our own. We were terribly angry with them. It was not an easy death. We are not sure to what extent he knew we were with him at the end. That haunts us. We were not able to tell him one last time, with assurance that he heard, that we love him. For somehow it seemed that he was far away from us in the process of his dying, that we should not intrude too much in his solitude. And that haunts us. He was given a sedative about 11 p.m. on our request, and that probably hastened the end, which came at 11:45. Did we do all we could to support and ease his way in those last 2 hours? We do not know. Where is he now, today? Has he found rest? On this day, the third anniversary, it is not easy to think of him as his old vital and intense self. I am too haunted by the memory of that gaunt face outlined sharply in a hospital bed. I remember too vividly his death throes. I pray that he has had 3 years of peace and that he is happy, that he is among friends, that he feels our love reach out to him. But what if there is nothing beyond? This is not a natural thought to me, yet I must acknowledge its possibility. Or worse, I contemplate this standing in my morning shower, trying to wake up. What if he is miserable? What if the state of the dead is a condition without shape or meaning, just frustrated, dark consciousness? I push this from my mind, and I pray with renewed fervor that he has found peace and is happy. I'll stop at that point, and the book ends a little more happily than that. Perhaps you'll look at it when it comes out. Thank you.
I'm very pleased to be invited to respond to these papers today, particularly because so much of what I have read of the papers that have been presented here and what I've heard today is so consistent with my own feelings and experiences. I had hoped at some point to receive some degree of personal revelation that would help me organize my thoughts and that would make the 15 minutes that I have to spend with you today somewhat meaningful, and unfortunately that hasn't happened. So I hope you will indulge me for a few minutes as I share some jumbled thoughts about what I've read and what I've heard today. My initial response to each of the papers that you've listened to today has been one of being moved by the personal stories that I've heard, again, because these are so consistent with the experiences that I've had in my life over the last several years. I'm encouraged by the involvement of the presenters here today, and I am also encouraged by your participation in this group. Wayne spoke of how his book ends in a more hopeful way. I tend to be somewhat of an eternal optimist and hope that what I can leave you with today is some of what I see as an encouraging signs that maybe HIV is becoming something that LDS people will deal with in an open and upfront way. Unfortunately, that means that we also have to deal with many other difficult things that are not only difficult for LDS people, but that are also difficult for Americans generally and perhaps worldwide, those being sexuality, as Dwight has discussed, suffering, drugs, and death. And none of those do we deal with very well in this country, outside of this community as well as within. I wanted, before I delve into this, just to make a couple of cautionary notes, particularly in relation to Dwight's paper. There are two things that concern me about some of what Dwight has spoken about, and the first is the issue of sexual addiction. I have for several years struggled with what that means, and I have come to the conclusion that sexual addiction is a very difficult
concept to operationalize. And I think that how sexuality is experienced within the LDS community certainly highlights that difficulty. When we speak of sexual addiction among LDS people, that might very well mean that I am doing something that is inconsistent with my values or with what I've been taught, particularly the kinds of things that we've discussed here today, and that I feel badly about that. And yet, in spite of those bad feelings, in spite of the desire not to participate in those activities, I continue to do them because the desire and the drive for sexual fulfillment is a very powerful one. On the other hand, a person can have many partners and can go well beyond that 8.5 sexual experiences per week or per month or whatever that was and feel completely satisfied with that and not feel troubled by that. So that's where the difficulty comes. Which one of these people is a sexual addict? Does it have to do with the number of sexual contacts? Does it have to do with the incongruence of sexual behavior with personal values and beliefs? So it has very little to do with what you presented, Dwight, and has a lot more just to do with the concept generally. I also think that Dwight's paper points to the difficulty that we have in assessing the sexual behavior of LDS people, particularly when we're talking about sexual behavior that is inconsistent with well-known teachings. Extramarital sex, premarital sex are very difficult things to have LDS people acknowledge, even when you do research in a very anonymous, large-scale survey sort of way. So what that ends up, the problem that ends up presenting for us is that it's really difficult to know, do LDS people do more or less than people around the country? Do we do things differently as a group of people than other people do? And I don't think we're very close to understanding that. And I think that will continue as we look into sexuality and do research around sexuality and LDS and LDS people and groups of LDS people, that's going to be a continually difficult situation for us. And finally, and this is more of a suggestion than anything else, but I would suggest that, Dwight, that now since we have an idea of what needs to be done, that the next step is going to be a very difficult one, and that is to implement the suggestions that you've made. And I applaud you for what you've said, and I, as a sexuality educator and sex therapist, certainly believe in those as the suggestions as something that we need to do. I think making that leap is going to be a very difficult one. So let me get on track very quickly. The papers that we've heard here today remind us that that LDS church members are fast becoming a part of the growing group of HIV-infected and affected, and I think we need to understand that the effect of HIV is not limited to the infection, but in fact that we as a group of people are affected by HIV infection and by this disease. I suspect that neither of the presenters here today thought that they would be touched by HIV in the early days of the AIDS epidemic, as I did when I was sitting in a session during some training on sexual dysfunction treatment and recognition and diagnosis about the time that Wayne's son was dying. And we had a section in that group about sexually transmitted diseases, and I suspected we'd be talking about syphilis and gonorrhea and things that I had heard about before and wasn't, wasn't terribly interested in. And then when we started talking about HTLV-3, precursor to HIV, I completely spaced out and knew that AIDS would never be something that would touch my life or have anything to do with what I wanted to do with my life professionally or personally. It wasn't more than a year and a half later that I found myself in the heart of New York City, working with the New York City Board of Education, evaluating their HIV and AIDS curriculum in their public schools, and also dealing very much more directly with people who are HIV infected in a long-term residential drug treatment program. That's where that became more real to me. As I came home from my experiences outside of Utah, I started to realize that there are more people that are affected than myself or than the presenters that you see here today. When I sat at the dinner table and discussed my work in New York City with my mother, who is a very traditional LDS woman, and who was able to name off three people within our neighborhood, extended neighborhood, within a 10-block radius, that she knew had died of HIV infection. That impresses me a great deal. The papers that we've heard today also remind us that religious institutions and organizations have been shamefully slow in responding to the spread of HIV. In fact, religious leaders have often said or done absolutely nothing And I think at times this inaction has sent a message more powerful than any sermon that could ever be preached or spoken over the pulpit about how much the religious world, in this case the LDS religious world, feels about the subject. And unfortunately, when religious groups and individuals have spoken out about HIV and AIDS, it's typically been a voice with a voice of criticism and hostile condemnation. What I'd like to spend a few minutes sharing with you are some of my impressions that I think are very consistent with what you've heard here today, and which rise both out of the papers that I was able to read a few days before this response, and also things that I have been thinking about the difficulties we have in dealing with HIV and AIDS in among LDS people. And one thing that I want to suggest is that living here in Utah and having lived outside of Utah and been actively involved in the LDS Church in both situations, and as a missionary and having traveled around quite a bit, it strikes me that what I used to hear on my mission frequently, that the church is the same everywhere you go, is not necessarily true, and that there are many challenges with dealing with HIV and AIDS in Utah among LDS Utah people that may be very different with dealing, in contrast to dealing with HIV and AIDS in New York City. That became very clear to me when I went to present at a Relief Society health fair in Queens, New York, and was very careful not to put the word condom in any of my presentation, although I found as I was sitting in the chapel listening to the first speaker that I had condoms in my briefcase. I wasn't about to talk about that because I figured that this was something that would not go over very well. Well, it didn't take more than 5 minutes into my presentation that one of the people in attendance raised the issue of condoms, since we were in the midst of the chancellor of the public schools wanting to distribute condoms in the public schools. So the issue came up, and the discussion was very open, and I thought very fruitful. I think that would be a lot less likely to happen in this area. I don't know. I mean, my vision may be a little warped here. As a director of community education at the Utah AIDS Foundation, I've been involved in the recent development of a coalition of HIV and AIDS educators in the state of Utah. And we've developed a mission statement as one of the first activities to do as a coalition. And this mission statement contains two very specific missions that we hope to accomplish as a group and as individual educators. One is to ensure that Utah residents, since that's where we're working, receive accurate and up-to-date information concerning HIV and AIDS. And the second is to promote toward those whose lives are affected by HIV and AIDS. And the papers that you've heard here today, I think, help illustrate a number of barriers to accomplishing both of those missions. And those are the things that I'd like to share with you today. So if you want to take notes, I'll kind of do a 1-2-3 sort of thing, and you can write these down. The first that both presenters have discussed is the silence that pervades LDS communities, silence about sexuality. Silence about sexual activity among LDS teens, about homosexuality and same-sex orientation, silence about extramarital sex, and what happens is that the belief, this I think is driven by the belief that open discussion of sexuality will encourage or promote sexual activity in some way, and I think DeWhite has made a good point that that's not empirically supported. That in fact, what open discussion does with sexuality is helps teenagers in particular make more sensible choices about their sexual behavior. We're at 5 minutes already, and I have so much more to say. Something else that I've recognized very powerfully here in Utah is that within the church we develop a sexuality-spirituality dichotomy. And that these two concepts are mutually exclusive, that one cannot be sexual and spiritual at the same time. DeWhite, in his presentation, referred to this as we are either carnal or virtuous. And I think this pervades our culture. This dichotomy is likely the result of the sexuality that we experience, the silence that we experience around sexuality, and the clear message that this silence is given. Sexuality and spirituality are incongruous. Therefore, if one feels very strongly sexual, one must give up one's spirituality in order to experience that sexuality. And I think that that was an experience that Wayne Sun has probably spoken about in his journals and certainly must have experienced. On the other hand, in order to be completely spiritual, one must be almost completely asexual. And And what that ends up doing is it causes us to split one part of the wholeness of humanity off in order to experience the other part. And that becomes very troublesome in trying to not only promote safer sexual behaviors, but in also trying to promote compassion. There's also a great deal of stigma, as we've talked about, associated with the common means of transmission of HIV, sex in particular, homosexuality, drug use, and the belief that bad things only happen to bad people. And the result is often a denial of personal or community risk, and the thought is that good church members will never be infected and therefore will never be affected. And this stigma also gets generalized, as we've heard spoken of today, to those who are infected by HIV in other ways, and also to friends, family members, and associates of those who are HIV positive or who have AIDS. There's also a very strong emphasis on saving souls. If you think about the threefold mission of the church, one is to preach the gospel to, I'll get this wrong, to preach the gospel, we'll leave it at that. And the whole idea is that preaching the gospel is an attempt to save souls. When we at the Utah AIDS Foundation or elsewhere who are doing HIV and AIDS education suggest that what we're doing is attempting to save lives, that message is not always the most important message when the contrasting message is one of saving souls. What does it mean to encourage someone who's participating in some kind of activity that drives them closer and closer to the boundaries of hell? What good would it be to save that person's life? And in fact, letting that person die prematurely would possibly save them further trouble in the life beyond. And I think that's a real powerful message that we don't think about. We also, LDS populations, or high concentrations of LDS populations, tend to live in areas where there's a low incidence of HIV infection, and therefore we have a much more limited experience of HIV around us. We also have limited LDS institutional response, and this has given church members the sense that HIV and AIDS is a little concern to us. We also have a very strong pioneer heritage with a strong emphasis on the independent resolution of personal and family difficulties. And Wayne, I think, could probably relate very well to this. Families that are affected by HIV and AIDS are isolated and left to deal with the HIV infection on their own. And finally, is the fact that we tend to not recognize the increasing multicultural nature of LDS people. We watch the number of converts go up and the membership of the church increase to 8.5 million or 9 million or whatever it is today, and not recognize that many people that are coming into the church are people who are not like most of what this group is, white, middle class, educated. And yet we want to, if we in fact do deal with HIV and AIDS, we deal with it in that sort of a context. I do, as I said before, have reasons for hope. One thing that causes me to hope is that the LDS Church as an organization contributes both directly and indirectly to the Utah AIDS Foundation. We run a food bank and we run a buddy program and a number of other support programs that are supported both directly and indirectly by the church as an organization. Even more encouraging than that, and this happens more often, is that individual LDS members make tremendous contributions in the form of money, food, and service to our organization and other AIDS service organizations in this state. Also, the awareness of HIV and its impact seem to be increasing, and that is evidenced by this, session today and your participation here. And also, I had the opportunity at a recent meeting of the Association of Mormon Counselors and Psychotherapists to participate in a breakout session that was entirely devoted to HIV and AIDS. Tragically, I was one of four people that attended that session. So while there's a glimmer of hope on the one hand, our response to that is kind of pallors that a little bit. Also, speakers from my speakers bureau are invited frequently to address predominantly LDS audiences, and I think it's a tremendous shame and tragedy that Wayne and his family have not been asked to share their experiences, when in fact I get to go around and do that a lot, and I don't have that kind of personal experience to share with people. I've been invited, for example, to speak at Brigham Young University to social work students. We've spoken to educational programs down there. I've been invited to Relief Society meetings and groups of young men and young women, not only to talk about HIV and AIDS, but to talk about sexuality and what that means in the context of LDS values. That allows me a certain degree of latitude. also the speakers that we send out and that other organizations send out to do education. And again, when I talk about education, I'm not just talking about how do you put on a condom and how is HIV transmitted and how do we prevent it, but also how can we be more compassionate towards people whose lives are affected by HIV and AIDS. Speakers who go to other groups that are not necessarily LDS audiences, like college classes and school classes, civic groups, workplaces, also, in, at least in this state and others where there are large concentrations of LDS people, are reaching individual LDS people with that kind of education. In conclusion, again, let me thank you for inviting me here today, and I appreciate hearing and being moved by what I've heard today. The suffering that accompanies HIV infection and AIDS reaches deep and penetrates beyond the limits of physical pain. At times, the pain of emotional and spiritual suffering far exceeds that of the physical maladies. AIDS has left much of the world feeling powerless in its wake, and I think the LDS community is experiencing that in a very strange way. This is something that's affecting us in ways that we don't quite get, and it's causing us to rethink and challenging some of our old traditions and old beliefs. As people of faith, there's much we can do in the age of AIDS to heal, to comfort, to care for, and to protect. We carry a message of hope, a message of love, and a message of the importance of each individual in the eyes of God. The AIDS epidemic challenges religious adherents to move beyond their own trivial and imperfect judgments and seek to live as their prophets and leaders who so often exemplified absolute love. In the face of AIDS, we can learn to apply the most fundamental of our beliefs, the unconditional love of humankind. And in so doing, we become a part of the solution rather than a part of the problem. Thanks.
We'd like to thank Dwight and Wayne and Mark for their comments and presenting their papers. We're very short on time. We may have room for about one, maybe two questions if there's... Okay, for the cassette recording. Would you consider presenting your paper for publishing in the Ensign? Isn't that what you had asked?
Sure.
Thank you. Let's take one last question, and then we'll need to close.